History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And you know what I'm going to say next. Do they really have to go untold? No, not if we're willing to ask a few questions. And perhaps more importantly, to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we become educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Memorial Day weekend when we pause as a nation to remember all of those who have given what President Abraham Lincoln so powerfully described as their last full measure of devotion, those who have died while serving our country. If you ever find yourself confused about Memorial Day and Veterans Day and can't remember the difference, there's a simple way of remembering that. I haven't heard it said any better than this. While Veterans Day in November is the day where we're reminded that when it comes to our veterans, all gave some, on Memorial Day, we honor the some who gave all. I hope you have the chance this Memorial Day to participate in observances where you live, and why not say a special prayer for our Gold Star families who have the memory of that loved one lost brought front and center again. You may have heard me mention it once upon a time, but the very existence of this program can be traced back to a Gold Star family a century ago when my great-great-grandmother lost her son in World War I. He was one of America's first military pilots. While the focus on Memorial Day will always be those Gold Star heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, over the years it's also become a time when families reflect on veterans in their families who survived their military service but have since left us. And today we're going to learn about a new memorial which will honor hundreds of them in a very special way at a very special place, and how you can help keep their memory alive. You've heard hundreds of veterans on Hometown Heroes over the years, many of whom I've had the privilege of meeting in their homes, and sometimes in veterans' homes that the government established so no veteran would be left behind. I'm thinking of state veterans' homes we visited in Idaho and Utah and New Mexico and elsewhere where these vets have shared their stories with us. And in California, we've been to the oldest state veterans' home in Yountville to one of the newest in Fresno, which is nearing completion on a special tribute that will end up featuring many of the vets we've heard on this program. To start bringing that picture into focus, let's bring in Julie Cusseter, Public Information Officer for the Veterans Home of California in Fresno.
Well, the state of California is unique in that we have 8 veterans home within the state. And Fresno was the 7th of the 8 homes that was built. We opened in October of 2013, so it'll be 10 years this year. And we provide a myriad of services to our local veterans. We have what we call RCFE, Residential Care Facility for the Elderly. That's what most people refer to as like assisted living. Those are for residents who are still kind of moving and grooving. Many of them still drive, get around, do their own thing, leave pretty independent lives. And then there's skilled nursing. Those are, of course, a higher level of care for skilled nursing. And then we have a memory care unit. So the memory care unit and the skilled nursing units have nurses on staff. We have 3 doctors that work here at the facility. We have our own clinic. When we're full, we have upwards of 300 people that live here. We have individual rooms. We even have a couple of couple rooms for those couples that live here. Non-veteran spouses also live here at the home. And we have a full, vibrant activities department. We have our on-site recreational therapists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists. We try to provide as much service on-site as we can, but then we also partner with our local VA hospital in providing medical services. And we have upwards of over 350 people that actually work here. So we have a lot of people that work here and a lot of people to care for our veterans.
So it's been almost 10 years. How many of those original residents 10 years ago still live here?
Well, we have a couple. We have resident number 1, Bill Carr, who still lives here. I'd say out of the original, what I call the original 30, there's maybe three that are left. That's the hard part about working here. You spend as much time here with these veterans as you do with your own family, so they become part of your family. And you get to know them, for better or for worse. We share all the ups and downs and highs and lows of life together. It's just our honor to work here, truly. It's been life-changing for me to work here.
Do you ever find yourself walking through a particular part of this big complex and a memory strikes in and it's a veteran who's no longer with us that you got to know and made an impression or shared a story with you?
All the time. All the time. In the dining room, we were just talking about golf, and Gordon Scott, who you remember, was very involved in the golf world. And I remember having many Monday morning conversations with him after a big golf tournament, and talking to him about golf and his life and his experiences. And we shared a lot of really wonderful, wonderful conversations. And again, that's part of working here is you aren't always in your office. You're roaming around. You're talking to the residents. And honestly, that's all they want from you is a little bit of your time. They want somebody to talk to. They want somebody to share experiences with. And, you know, your time's free. Why not give some of it?
There are a lot of ways you can help at a state veterans home near you. And we're going to learn more about the new memorial being planned. You can find artist renderings of it online at hometownheroesradio.com. But Julie mentioned one name that's going to be inscribed on that wall, Gordon Scott. He went on to run the Northern California Golf Association. But that never would have happened if he hadn't survived the sinking of the carrier USS Lexington in the Battle of the Coral Sea in May of 1942.
Some of our scout planes sighted the Japanese fleet in carriers and cruisers, battleships and everything. We sent planes and attacked them and sank one carrier and damaged another one. And then the next day, our planes were going back and attack them again. They had spotted us in the meantime. In mid-flight, here was a fleet from the care of their carriers coming back to attack us. And they passed each other going, we're going to attack them and they're coming to attack us. Well, they got to us about 11 o'clock in the morning. They came in with dive bombers and torpedo planes. We took one torpedo hit on the port side and took two bomb hits, one in the superstructure on the starboard side and another bomb hit on one of the gun stations on the port side. There was a lot of damage, but our planes came back, and we had never had over an 8-degree list on the ship, and we landed, got back into the wind to land our planes that were coming back from attacking them, and landed our planes back, didn't land all of them, but we landed the ones that were there. Then they were refueling our planes to go back for another attack, and apparently it had ruptured some gasoline lines internally in the ship and was spewing gas out. That's very high octane gas, and it started burning up inside. And indirectly, the Japanese didn't sink us from their bomb hits or torpedo hits, but our ship burned up. That was at 11 something in the morning, and we didn't abandon ship till 5:18 that night.
And you're describing that, and I'm thinking, what did that look like? What did that feel like? And as you described, you still had to land your plane, so you're still there at your duty station, and your ship is damaged and on fire. Let's start here, maybe. Can you help us understand what that felt like when the torpedo and those bombs hit the Lexington?
I was about to, what we call the barrier cables that stop the planes if they're going to crash. Needless to say, people say they're not scared. I think they're damn liars. But was back right by the superstructure. And when we were attacked, pretty good jolt when you get a torpedo hit and a bomb hit, or one of the bomb hits in the superstructure right above us where we were. And I don't know, it's quite a feeling. It's hard to explain, really. We would send crews down fighting the fire internally. In the Navy, from where the ship was first built, I think they painted every week for an inspection. And I don't know how thick the paint was on the metal between and all the compartments, but they had doors that you could what call them, dog them down with latches on them and close them like locking a door in a house. It would get so hot on one side, it would start paint burning on the other side. So literally, that just went from compartment to compartment and dogging them down, burning, crews going down. Then people more and more began coming up on the flight deck. We had a little over probably 2,000 people aboard the ship. I don't know if there wasn't 2,000 up there because there were still people going down and fighting the deal. and just waiting. I mean, a period of waiting, that was from 11 to 5 o'clock that night, just laying there, just ship burning up internally. People would get a little scared, and they'd take life rafts, rubber life rafts that were in the planes, and inflate them, throw them over the side, and there's quite a bit of current in the ocean, and these life rafts would just float away. One of the deals that I think it was, if I remember right, it was probably 5:18 that night when they told us to abandon ship. I'll never forget it. There was a destroyer that came alongside, and I went down, and I was in the water and got picked up by the destroyer. I looked up, and here was a guy that was one of the squadron. We called him Porky Pref. He was in the torpedo squadron. Had inflated a big three-man or five-man life raft, and he tied a line to his wrist and another one to the raft and had some guys throw it over the side. Well, I was down on the destroyer, just got picked up, and I looked up, and here he come. He forgot how far it was to the water, and that the raft got down to the water before he did. And I never seen the guy again for several years.
So you weren't in the water all that long? You got picked up quickly?
Got picked up and was later transferred to a cruiser, the USS Portland, transferred to a cruiser. And we were black from smoke and kind of sick and scared and everything else. And it was then starting to get dark, and we just laid down in one of the compartments of the ship. And cruisers have a couple seaplanes that they send up in scouting for the cruisers. That morning they shot one off, and we thought, my God, here we go again, someone's bombing the ship. But they had just shot one of the cruiser planes off.
So the Lexington went down there in May of 1942, and obviously you survived, and a lot were able to get off. You talked about the abandoned ship. When did you realize how many fellow sailors you lost that day?
We ended up in the Tonga Islands. We were in Tonga Tabu in the Tonga group. Tonga is several different islands. When we were there, well, there was a hospital ship there. So a lot of our people were injured, went there, and several of them even died afterwards on the hospital ship. And a lot of people had to stay there. The rest of us were put on a transport that was in Tonga. We stopped back at Pearl Harbor and picked up some Marines that had been going back to the U.S. We came back to San Diego. We pulled in what they called a destroyer base. It's in the south from downtown San Diego, way back in the destroyer base. That was in late afternoon, and they announced that anybody that had families in San Diego could go ashore that night. Well, I had a brother that was a foreman in one of the aircraft plants in San Diego, so I got to go ashore, and went down to the aircraft plant there, and he worked on a late night shift. Went up to the security there and told him who I was, and I was dungarees and no uniform, and the guy kind of looked at me suspiciously, and he radioed in or called in on the phone and got a hold of my brother, and he came out, and he couldn't believe it. He says, "Did you desert the Navy?" We weren't supposed to tell anybody, but I had to tell him what happened, and we got back, and later they issued us clothing and everything the next day and got us all straightened out. Got to come back home to Kingsburg and still hadn't said anything. I was walking down the streets here in Kingsburg when it came back and out in the news, and there was a fellow here from the Kingsburg Recorder newspaper that hunted me down and wanted to know what happened.
Your ship's been sunk. Your brother doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But here all of a sudden you are, and they're wondering why. That had to be a pretty surreal kind of stretch of time there.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a deal. But I was fortunate. I got to come back to Kingsburg for a short time. Went back to San Diego after about 3 or 4 weeks. There's six of us. They divided us up in different sections. At first they tried to see if we couldn't get another carrier that was being built or about ready to get out of building. And rename it the Lexington and put the whole crew on it, but they couldn't do that. So they divided our V1 division, which was the resting gear on the carrier, and they sent six of us to the Naval Air Station and shipyards in Philadelphia. And they were just starting a training school there. They were building so many Jeep carriers and other carriers at that time, they didn't have people trained really to man the deals. So they were setting up a deal, and they used the six of us for a while there in the training program to set it up. And then after about possibly a month, we were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, to the naval base there. Went aboard another carrier, the USS Sewanee. And after a short time, we went out to sea, had a group of new pilots qualify them. Some of them hadn't been landing on carriers. That was an experience, too, because there was a lot of accidents. And then after maybe a week or two, we got left out of there and went to Bermuda. Then we done the same thing. We came out of Bermuda and trained more pilots, landing more. We had a catapult on this carrier, launching planes and landing them back and training everybody on the ship. And might say that basically, by and large, the biggest percentage of the personnel on the ship had never been to sea before. We had one experience to show the lack of training. They had a plane hooked up on a catapult, and we were going to sea, and it sounded flight quarters. And this plane, normally you would never hook a plane up with a catapult. You put what they call a bridle up on the plane and attach it to the catapult. And this was all hooked up there. And I was there talking to one of the guys that was with us, leaning against the plane, and turned and went to the bridge just to get adjacent to us. And I heard a click, and I turned around, and here this plane had been fired off of the catapult and mowing people down, going down the deal. No one in the plane, and the plane wasn't turning up, and it was terrible. This friend of mine that had been there, the plane just run right over him. He'd hurt his back real bad, and he was in the hospital for a long time and killed, quite a few people and maimed a lot of people. And it was a terrible accident.
Again, I'm struck by something you said there. You said you had just walked away right before. If you had still been standing where you were, what would have happened to you?
That's right. I mean, I've been very lucky. Well, I think the good Lord looked after me. I tell you, there was a lot of times that I prayed out there when I was at sea. I don't know why I was picked to survive. And I just can't believe it. I mean, because there have been so many. There was other close calls would happen aboard ship a lot of times. I had one deal that a plane crashed, and I crawled under the turret of this big gun. And about that far, this plane crashed right into this thing. And so there's just so many things. A friend of mine, I'm standing one, we were having night carrier landings one time, and I'm standing talking to him, and was off of Honolulu out of Pearl Harbor. Prior to the war, we're training program, or people night flying and night carrier landings, and a plane comes in and busted one of the, what we call the cross-deck pennants that stops the planes, and it whipped around. I'd just been talking to him, and I turned around, and I hadn't got 10 yards away from him, and this plane crashed or busted this barrier cable or cross-deck pennant and hit him and took his leg off. We had a little net off the side of the ship like this, and it was dark, and they just heard somebody moaning and found him here in the net. But he was fortunate. He lost a leg. But, I mean, there are just so many things that crashes. Another time a plane chased me in the flight deck that was coming in for a landing. I was up on the flight deck, and I just bailed out over the side into where the gun turrets were down there. Knocked a guy flat down there, and I just head first. And this plane here, one wing was in the deck, flight deck, and the other one on top one of the guns down there. Just so many things that happened. Like I say, the good Lord had to be looking out for me.
The late Gordon Scott, one of more than 400 names that'll be displayed in perpetuity at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, thanks to a new memorial to be unveiled this fall. We'll put a couple of other stories behind those names and let you know how you can help bring this ambitious project to fruition when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance on this Memorial Day weekend to learn about a new memorial in progress. It's going to end up listing the names of quite a few veterans we've met on this program over the years. those who finish their journeys on Earth at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can see plans for this memorial and even participate in a very personal way that we're going to flesh out in a bit. That amazing facility is soon going to celebrate its 10th anniversary. Its very existence traces back to the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation, which fought to get it built and has continued to support its residents in ways the government can't. More now from Public Information Officer Julie Cusseter.
The foundation said, what if we did some sort of memorial for all these veterans that have passed away? So we started looking into it, and one thing led to another, and we have the Fresno Veterans Home Memorial Project. And that memorial project has blossomed into a huge event where we've gotten support from different companies throughout the Central Valley. Well-known, you know, architects and engineers, electricians have volunteered their time, have donated their time and talents and designs. Design Lab 252 they came up with the plans for this project, and it's going to be at the entrance of the home. As you're walking in, you park in the visitor area. There are going to be 5 walls and 5 benches. There's going to be a pillar in the middle that'll have all the different branches of the military on it, and it's going to have all the names, year of birth, year of death, and branch of service that the veterans served in. Right now, we'll probably have over 400 names on those walls, which you talk about experiences and triggering memories. Going through this experience, reaching out to all these family members, checking on their contact information, has been a real emotional journey for me, because I remember all these veterans, many of them I was close to and I had a relationship with. And so we are very excited about this project, and we're very excited about when we're going to be unveiling it. It'll be coincide with our 10-year anniversary. So it's going to be a huge event that will take place on October 18th, 2023. It's a Wednesday. Like I said, we're just really looking forward to this project coming to fruition. It's been quite a journey for the foundation and myself to go through. We've been very fortunate. Also, we got assistance from Congressman Jim Costa through appropriation funding. His staff said we might be eligible to apply for appropriation funding, and we were granted that money, and that's going to help us build this project. So we're very, very grateful to Congressman Costa and his staff for helping us out.
And you can help in that effort too. Go to hometownheroesradio.com to find out how, and Julie's going to spell it out more clearly by the time we finish our program today. But let's hear now from the president of the Central California Veterans Home Support Foundation, himself a Vietnam veteran from the 82nd Airborne, Glenn McGee.
Well, the foundation is the group that got together to build this home in the first place. They had the vision to build this home. It's a crazy history of some pretty important people here in this town that had this vision, and we can go through the names and everybody would understand who they were. Most of all are gone, but as we say, the home opened 10 years ago. It was a $185 million project. The funds were brought in by this foundation and built this home and gave a place for these veterans that live here in the Central Valley and other places, actually, a place to live. The foundation is only a small group of people that are really interested. Nobody's paid. Nobody even makes their expenses, nothing. All the money that we receive to the foundation has to go back into the veterans here at the home. That's our bylaws. That's what we do. And it's amazing what we're able to accomplish primarily by people just giving to us. We have a spaghetti dinner every year in October that pays for Christmas. The people here generally have no Christmas at all. Their families sometimes ignore them. That's more the case than you think. And we supply a Christmas present every year and some other things. And it's really a great time when we fill those stockings in December for all these veterans. But these guys and gals here in this home, they look forward to those stockings every year, and they know they're going to get something. If you look around, you'll see them wearing shirts that we gave them, or pullovers or bags or whatever we give them. And they're very appreciative of that. And that's what we do. And now we've got this huge project of building a memorial wall out here, walls, that we can put these names of those that have passed. I've gotten to know a lot of these guys. I've been president of this foundation now for 7 years, I think, or eight.
Really?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Wow.
And I've gotten to know these guys very, very well. And then Julie tells me, Mr. Appleton just died, these different friends that I've made. It's hard because I'm a veteran myself. I'm a Vietnam veteran. So I feel a brotherhood with these other guys, and they feel it with me that I'm one of them. And this is a wonderful place to live. The people that live here, the veterans themselves, if you talk to them about this wall, they tear up even thinking that we're even considering doing this. And they are just loving the idea. We've had veterans here from Pearl Harbor survivors. We still have at least one lady. She's 104, and she was a nurse in World War II, and she still is pretty active. And we've got several of these individuals that we really owe a lot to, and they all have a story.
Let's hear another one of those stories. Glenn mentioned Pearl Harbor survivors. The home has ended up with a couple Pearl Harbor survivors who've shared their stories on this program, including a Purple Heart Marine named Elmer Wright.
Late about, missed about 20 minutes after the explosion there in Pearl Harbor. We had general quarters. We didn't have no ammunition or nothing, but we stood out with our rifles and all that, but I don't know what we could have done. Didn't have ammunition for them.
And where were you guys?
Right outside the harbor. Now, they never bombed nothing outside the harbor. They never bombed the sub base either. They hit the Maryland, U.S. Maryland. They hit it in number one turret and busted it. That's the ship I was supposed to went on, but so we waited there in the, I think the Colorado was in Brampton, Washington then. When it come there, we went aboard there.
So you're on this oil tanker outside of Pearl Harbor, and the first thing that tells you something that's going on is they sound general quarters and say, we're under attack, we're at war, or what?
Yeah. Well, everybody was kind of decided. Now, the two Japanese planes come. It was coming back from Pearl Harbor after they jumped the bomb. They flew right over us, but someone said, yeah, they're Japanese. Then the second or third day, they lowered a boat, rowboats, and we didn't have motors. And there were nine of us, and we made a landing down there outside Pearl Harbor in the cane field there, and I was sick. And I wanted to lay down and let them go, and they said, no, we don't leave no Marines behind. And we went on that way. We got made into Marine barracks before dark, but boy, I was sick that day. It didn't matter to me what happened. I didn't think I was going to make it. But about 3 days later, I got feeling better, and they made a mess cook out of me. And that about 7 or 8 days, and we started putting out balloons up in the air with cables on them in case planes come in that hit them cables. And the second day after we got the balloons up there, one of our own planes hit it out there in the harbor.
Well, some have said that if they actually had barrage balloons in place before December 7th, that it would have prevented the air attack or at least limited it. I've got to ask you about that scene there, though, on December 7th. Do you remember looking out and seeing the aftermath of that attack, seeing the smoke from the Arizona?
When night come around, you could see it real good, too. Yeah, we must have been a mile out from the entrance of the harbor.
So you said when night fell, you could see it. So you could still see fire burning, or what?
Yeah, flash, a lot of smoke.
Most of us, you know, we've seen the footage, we've seen the pictures, but we weren't there. We didn't smell it. We didn't see it with our own eyes. What was it like in real life to look out and see that? What did you see, and what did it feel like?
It's a hard thing to tell how a guy felt.
Did it hurt to know that so many Americans had died there?
Yeah. I was strictly Marines. We were ship, we were a company of Marines there, but we were just like a more loved family. We knew the strength of each man and what he could do and everything. And we hate to see one of our own men killed, but it didn't bother me too much. Sailors was killed, but should have, but I had a lot of friend sailors.
And I don't want to keep you here too long, but I want people to understand, because you hadn't seen any action yet. I mean, you've been part of this movie, and but this is real. War is here, and people are dying. Did that add some fuel to your fire? Did that motivate you to go out there and fight the Japanese?
Not really. We mostly concentrated on our job, what we had to do. I know one time, well, it's off Saipan, there's eight planes coming 80 miles away. The time we got up on the guns, the planes was already there. I think we knocked down three or four of them. And one of them, torpedo dropped a torpedo, hit one of the ships.
I did mention Elmer Wright was a Purple Heart Marine, and that part of his story would occur on the battleship USS Colorado.
I had a lot of fear for the guys that got killed, but now we'd buried a bunch of them at sea there. We had a rifle team, but I don't know if they were sailors or Marines, what they were, but we had a firing team. We'd put a stretcher, two 5-inch shells in a stretcher, and lowered to the side and buried them at sea. We done that all day once. I don't know how many we buried there, but I think most of them were sailors. But on Tinian now down there, when we come back to Guam, we fired star shells. A lot of Japanese swimming from Saipan over Tinian. We kept that going all night long. But some Japanese officers convinced our officers that there wasn't very many troops on Tinian, but he was wrong. But 2nd, 4th Marines, I don't think they had any trouble at all on the other side of the island.
Right, but the side you're on, and this is late July 1944, you're on the USS Colorado. You've already participated in the bombardment of Saipan and Guam, and now you're at Tinian, famous, of course, as the launching point for the Enola Gay a year later. But as you're helping to capture this island in July of 1944, you are working on your gun emplacement, other guys blasting away with theirs. But you were a little closer to shore than usual, and your ship received some serious damage there.
Our ship got hit. I don't know why we was in there so close. Well, the machine gun fire, you could see it flash up out of this buck brush and stuff. We were firing machine guns there. We could have got out there 5 miles away from the island and with those heavy guns and battered that out. Yeah, there's a big battery in the way up on the ridge, come out of a cave, a tunnel. And we supposed to made a, troops made a fake landing on the side we was on. We was on the north side, and the 4th and 2nd Marines is on the other side. We supposed to draw the enemy to our side, but we did all right. And there were 7 barges there, and they sunk every one of those. Our ship had just sat there to close, just go around. Starboard side all fire than the port side. I don't know why the skipper kept doing that. Instead of trying to get away from them, get out of the line of fire, we could have been out there 10 miles still bombed that island.
And you were on a 20-millimeter the whole time?
Yeah, we had, the 7 of us got killed on that group. We had 3 guns there and 10 men there. I can name most of them. Platoon Sergeant Bunch, he was laying there on the gun tub. He was laying there at the end, something coming out of his throat, so he was dead. And on the gun I was on there, we had 3 men to a gun, and I had Narboard. We had 1 guy hanging in the harness. He got killed. He was laying there in the harness, still the gun sticking up in there. Then Narboard come down. He fell right on his stomach right in front of me. I was standing there, and I got pretty bad in my leg and back wounds. And Private Glass come and fell right over the top of him. He was mumbling something to me. I never could figure out what he was saying. But and I seen blood come out of his mouth, and he gulped, and he died. And there was Sabinski at the other end, Corporal Sabinski. He had his whole leg shot off, and he was standing up on that one leg praying. And still alive, and there was a couple of corpsmen come up there. They bandaged my leg up, put a tourniquet around it and everything. And I said that I told him to take care of Sabinski first. And all we can't help him. Later on, they load us in stretchers. They'd load us down stretchers to the main deck. It was set up about 12, 14 feet below the main deck. Give me a good shot of morphine and take me down to the Marine quarters there and laid me down. Most all them guys was dead in there, laying there. And I says, boy, this can't happen to me. I thought maybe they'd take me for dead because I passed out from morphine, I guess. And when I woke up, I was on a hospital ship. I don't even remember them taking me off the ship even. And on there, the funny thing is a Japanese corpsman. I thought I was on a Japanese ship there for a while. And I played like I wouldn't open my eyes. And finally, a Navy commander come in there. And he wanted to know I was in. This guy above me, he got stepped on a mine. Boy, his leg was that big around. He's a lieutenant. And so this man talked to him. He says, try to keep him awake up there. Keep talking. He kept talking about the Keys College and all that. But he died that night. And we went on to New Caledonia, Mob 5 Naval Hospital there. And that was so bad, a couple guys come in to visit me that I was with on the ship there. They had minor injuries. One of them couldn't stand to even look at me. Now, I even attempted suicide. I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I got thinking, well, I'd take a sleeping pill. They'd put one up, put it on my pillow. I got about 7 or 8 of them. I was trying to blow that and knock me out. And so finally, they pumped my stomach and come out. And the chaplain, he sat there and he talked me out of the suicide stuff. And I really didn't want to come home. I didn't want people to see me like things are.
Wow. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your candor. You went through things that most people never will, and certainly none of us wants to, but you're really making this real for us and helping us understand not just what you went through, but what so many others did, and even today, the things our men and women in uniform are dealing with. You were on a roll there, and I didn't want to interrupt, but I do want to go back a little bit now. Obviously, you were in need of repair and healing, but your ship was too. You were on the USS Colorado, and this big battleship is in close to shore to shell Tinian, but the Colorado ended up taking 22 hits itself during this time, damaged badly enough that the ship would have to go back to the West Coast for repairs after that. And the Japanese, it seems, had a lot more firepower on that island than your leaders expected.
When that big gun come out of that mountain, they had a tunnel all the way through that mountain, its own tracks. Boy, they sure laid it on us.
When you saw those big shells coming your way, was that happening for a while before you yourself got wounded? Did you have time to...
When they started, we got hit right off. The two shells hit right amongst us, sir.
And what happened to you? Where did you get hit? What did it feel like? How did you react to that?
Well, I was on the... mostly Sabinski's down there on one leg to help him, but they put a terminal around my leg. Then when they left, I felt my coveralls on fire and put my hand out covered with blood. That kind of bothered me a little bit. They couldn't put no tourniquet on my buttocks. So they finally got it and trapped me in that stretcher and lowered me down. And they gave me a lot of morphine. I passed out.
So a shell from that big 8-inch gun came in, just exploded, and you didn't know where you were hit.
No. I know my shoe was off my foot, but my leg and my back injured. They never even checked my back. They put a tourniquet until they got the rest of the guys all the... They're taking the dead ones, the last is still laying up in the tub.
Was there any part of you that wasn't sure you were going to survive?
Yeah, and the ammunition box got on fire, and we had these 5 buckets of sand for incinerator bombs. They'd burn right through the deck. So I picked that up. That was after I was wounded, too, and I threw that at and covered that tank. I put the fire out. I got a Bronze Star for it. And on the other side of the Marine put out, he was a kind of a yard bird. Nobody liked him very much. The colonel gave him a Silver Star. So I met this colonel out by Dobbins, California, a couple of years ago. And I asked him, how come I just get a Bronze Star? And the other guy got, oh, he saved more lives than you did. Yeah, there wasn't but 3 of them. Yeah, it was Jones and Olson and me. That was only 3 that lived on that. All the rest of them were killed.
Elmer Wright came oh so close to being one of those over 400,000 Americans who did not come home from World War II, the ones we honor this Memorial Day weekend, along with all of those who have ever died in the service of our country. But Elmer's name will soon be on a memorial at the facility where he lived out his final days, and we'll learn more about that and how you can remember a vet who may otherwise be forgotten and help make that special memorial possible when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common 3-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful. And I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to learn this Memorial Day weekend about a new memorial in the works at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. There's a very special way you can support that effort, and we'll get back to Julie Cusseter in a moment to make that clear. You can also find more information online at hometownheroesradio.com. But let's explore the memories of another name that will end up etched on that memorial, another Purple Heart Marine who lived out his final days at that special facility. Max Roof's injuries came in the Battle of Iwo Jima.
I wasn't hit on the beach itself. I got hit further back in when they finally got a whole bunch of Japanese armor and actually men that came through and was hitting a bunch of us that got hit bad. And they did it, and that was what they're there for. But I was able to at least get back alive, and I came back in a. They didn't think I was even alive. They thought I was.
Well, I want to ask you more about that and get all the details. But between the time that you got there and the time you were wounded, there was a lot happening on this island, and of course. The most famous thing that happened on that island is something that you were there for. The flag went up. Well, it went up twice. Two different flags went up atop Mount Suribachi.
You're right.
What do you remember seeing and hearing, and what did it mean to you?
Well, I was in front. I never forget it. That one time, I was in front, and when there was a lot of explosion going on, and also, and I was kind of digging in along with about 10 other guys that were trying to get underneath it a little bit. So I did look back this one time and seen that we were kind of taking it over, but I was moving forward and to fight the Japanese out there that were still there, but it was in a sense kind of exciting to be there and to see that we're taking things over, at least physically, and I hope mentally as well.
But there's no time to cheer when somebody's shooting at you.
No, it wasn't. It was either die or not die. We had no choice. But that was okay. We made it out. And several thousand, I said earlier, that was killed in Evo. I wasn't one of them. But I had eventually four back operations, hip replacement, and a lot of internal injuries and so forth, but I came out fairly good.
Well, from what I hear, you came out awfully strong. Your wife is vouching for that.
My wife is the one that did it all. She is so powerful.
I want to hear the rest of this story, but I do want to ask you one more thing about Mount Suribachi and that indelible image, that Rosenthal photo of the group hoisting that flag. That photo is on the back of your business card. When you look at that photo now, when you look at the Marine Corps statue at Arlington National Cemetery there that honors those men and everyone who fought there, what do you think of when you see that image?
One thing, I feel proud. I really do. And I'm so proud that I went into the Marines, even though I got banged up pretty bad. But to me, I was proud, and I still am.
And I don't blame you. And of course, if anyone's been to that beautiful statue near Washington, D.C., that brings that photograph to life in a 3D sense, they've seen the quote on the side from Admiral Nimitz that says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue." Is that something that means something to you? Do you believe that to be true? Is that what you saw in the guys that you served with?
I have to say yes. In the Marines, good people now that I love dearly, who's Lieutenant Colonel and John Lockie, for example, and just guys that are just so super in every way and so thoughtful and so helpful in watching him and handle other Marines that need help in the way of mentally particularly. So I just am thrilled that I'm part of that. I'm way under their caliber, I'm telling you, but they really make me proud.
Are you saying once a Marine, always a Marine? Is that what I hear?
That's what you heard, sir. That's exactly correct.
Well, let's talk about this injury, because I know we've alluded to it a few times, but if you can, share with our listeners the details of what happened to you, what you were doing, where you got hit, what it felt like. Walk me through that if you can. What were you doing at that time?
I was fighting with a rifle, guys coming in like mad, Marines, and fighting Marines, I should say, but guys that were the Japanese, but also more Marines were coming in trying to protect. Everybody was there too. And when I got hit, the first time I got hit, or on Net Island, I almost mentally lost it. I just knew that I was hurt bad, but I kept kind of fighting, but not really. I kind of figured out what do I do next? Where do I go? And how do I get out of here? But I didn't until they picked me up in a blanket and got me out.
So it was shrapnel from a landmine and fragments of a hand grenade that got you at the same time?
It was mostly hand grenades that got hit me, that got me badly fouled up.
Where did it get you?
Pretty much all over in my body and so forth. But again, I got out, you know, I went immediately to the hospital, and then to the ship out to the hospital. They immediately flew me on to Guam, and I was in Guam Hospital for several months before I got back to Hawaii, and then they shipped me on then to San Francisco and then home.
Well, I'm sorry for all these questions about the same thing, but when you say that it took you several months to recover, I think we can all tell these were pretty serious injuries, and this hit your front, not your back? I mean, did you get it in the face, the shoulders? Where did it all go?
I can't answer that intelligently. I was bleeding all over, but I didn't get any scars, you know, as bad as you have. No, I'm just teasing. I am teasing.
I haven't looked in a mirror today.
No, I really just was I can't answer that really intelligently anymore. I'm just in regard to where I got hit on the back very seriously, and that's where I had four back operations.
Were you? I mean, I know that when there's an explosion, when there's shrapnel, sometimes you can be blinded temporarily.
That was exactly correct. I did go blind. Matter of fact, the operator on my eyes when they flew me to Guam, and I was couldn't see for about 2 weeks. And then they operated on three different times, the doctor told me later. So eyes was was a bad thing in my face and so forth. But you wouldn't take anything very large to knock your eye out, you know.
So this was a pretty big deal. I mean, you were hit pretty hard. Did you lose consciousness? Were you aware of what was going on, or were you completely out of it?
I would have to say I was aware of it. I wasn't completely out of it. I was hurting pretty bad. I wasn't crying like some of them were, and I wasn't. Didn't mean that's bad. I just wasn't. I was just just hurting. But I made it through.
And you couldn't, obviously, you couldn't evacuate yourself. You couldn't move yourself out of there. You had to wait for a corpsman to come help you?
No, I had to wait for almost an hour for some, they were picking other people up as well. And I was in the group where, for a lot of them were dead completely in the same area. And the two guys would pick us up, take us on over to the next little spot, and then somebody else would take over, and then they would come back and try to get somebody else, and did get somebody else.
Yeah, because, I mean, the battle's still raging on. It's not like they say, time out, we need to get some guys out of here. You have to wait for the guys that are actually walking to get you out. That seems like a very helpless situation to me. When you know you're hurt, you know you're bleeding, you can't move yourself, you're waiting for an hour. What kept you focused on surviving in that hour? That's probably one of the longest hours of your life, I would imagine.
It was pretty severe, I'll have to admit that. I could handle it and did handle it without any... It wasn't anybody's fault. It wasn't our fault that in the way of... They couldn't get to me, you know, but it was hurting so bad that I wasn't sure I was going to make it, frankly.
That was going to be my question. Did you think that you were going to die? And when that thought comes in your head, it seems like a lot of times it's downhill from there. That's not a thought that you want to go through your head, but you wondered if you'd make it?
Yeah, actually, that's correct. I didn't think I would. And I was, mine, I was 18 years old, or 19 at this point. So I haven't lived very long yet, but I didn't feel that, I just knew that I'd make it somehow or another, but if I didn't, I didn't, and that was kind of my philosophy a little bit too, even back then.
When you're in a situation like that with so many casualties as there were on that island in particular, sometimes stretchers can be in high demand and they're not always there when you need them. So they didn't have a stretcher to carry you out and they actually put you in a body bag?
A body bag's what it was, There were too many guys having need to help, you know, and so I don't even see a stretcher now. And looking back, all I seen was body bags, guys picking up in bag bags. There'd be two guys, one in front, one back, and they'd get us in and go.
So they took you to Guam, and you said months of recovery. It seems like that would be a challenging time to you too. What do you remember about that time period and the challenges that you faced just to be able to function again?
Yeah, that was tough. I have to admit that because I really was hurting all over, not just my eyes, but my whole body. For a long, long time, I couldn't walk, and it was miserable. I got to say that. And then when I couldn't talk either, I'm not talking very good now, I admit that. but then I was really, I stuttered just 100% almost. You couldn't even understand me and why I could go out and get a job and start my own business, to talk to people on how to do this, and talk about even whitewashing, you know, but I got it done.
When you think back of that time after you were injured, the long recovery, and then trying to get yourself back into life, was there one thing that really motivated you or picked you up or kept you moving forward?
It sure was one thing. And this sounds kind of goofy, but I did not want to be poor. That was the big thing. As I mentioned to you, my folks were just lovely, lovely, lovely. But because they lost all their money in back in the 30s in the Depression, and then they never recovered, really. And so I never experienced anything except I just didn't want to be just poor. I just had to make that was the main thing that made me go forward and I have to say be successful, and we were. And with six children and a beautiful wife, I was successful all over.
The late Max Roof, another of the more than 400 names that will be honored on the soon-to-be-unveiled memorial at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. But in order for that project to be completed in time for the home's 10th anniversary in October, some more funds need to be raised. And there's a really meaningful and personal way you can help with that, as we hear from Julie Cusseter.
As I mentioned before, majority of the funds for this project have been provided to us through appropriation funding and also through a group of local Rotary clubs. They were the original seed money for this project. Yeah. So after we got the Rotary money, we knew we needed more. We were able to get the appropriation funding. So now we're sort of at the home stretch. And we were trying to figure out how we were going to fill in the gap. First thing that I've been doing is communicating to all these families of all the people who passed mm-hmm. away. I first send them letters letting them know that we were doing this project, and then I'd follow it up with a letter letting them know if they were able to make a donation of $100, that would help pay for the engraving of their loved one's name, the year of birth, year of death, and the branch of military they served in. Another thing I discovered as I was doing this, there were a lot of names on this list, and the 400-odd names that I've been looking at, they had nobody. They might have had a neighbor or a friend or a conservator who was overseeing their affairs. I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we reached out to the community and let them adopt a vet, so to speak? So I call this project, the side project, Remember a Vet, where you or anyone, a member of the community, can sponsor the $100 to cover the engraving of this veteran's name, year of birth, year of death, and branch of military. And when you make that donation, I will send you a thank you letter, and it'll have a name of that veteran that you're supporting. And we want you to come to the unveiling of this project, and we want you to see that person's name on the wall so you can remember that person. So that's why we're calling it Remember a Vet. I sort of likened it to the Vietnam Wall. I went there years and years and years ago, and I remember seeing my friend sketching his great uncle's name, getting with a white piece of paper and a pencil. Well, there will be hundreds of families here doing the exact same thing, remembering their loved one. And here you are now remembering somebody who hasn't really been remembered by anybody. So what we're asking people to do, give me a call. My number is 559-493-4239. Give me a call and I'll give you information on how you can remember a vet.
I have that phone number and the rest of the information on this new memorial posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And I know many of you will be taking that initiative to remember a vet like those three whose memories we revisited today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on Memorial Day and every day, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.